Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Let's continue the conversation about another aspect of this case. Sheriff Nanos, his own deputies, just voted unanimously 241-0 to demand his resignation. Records reported by the Arizona Republic show Sheriff Chris Nanos resigned from the El Paso Police Department in 1982 in lieu of termination after allegedly accumulating 26 disciplinary allegations in 5 years, including excessive force and insubordination. His deputies say none of that was disclosed when he came to Pima County many, many years ago, 40-some years ago now. And according to reporting by the Arizona Republic and ASPM, when Nanos was asked in a December 2025 deposition whether ever he had ever been suspended, he reportedly testified that he had not in the course of his career. And he goes back and they're saying, I thought you were just talking about here in Pima County, even though the question was about his career. So the Board of Supervisors is now trying to compel him to answer these questions under oath. And also, his union wants him to resign. Jen, what are your thoughts on all this? Another vote of no confidence. It's not the first one that he's had. It's kind of a pattern and a track record that he's got going on. But he kind of does things his own way. What do you think when everybody's saying we don't believe in you? Is it time?
Well, you know what? He is a guy that I've really tried to give some deference to because yeah. It's difficult to be in his shoes. It's difficult to run an investigation with everybody breathing down your back, looking at your every move. But he has officially on my last nerve with all of the misinformation, the back and forth about the 11th, not knowing the date or at least saying it correctly that this that she went missing. The confusion about or not the confusion, I should say, the decision not to allow these searchers to search when now it's clear they don't have a pointer seems pretty clear. I actually gave him deference on that because I said, listen, you know what, public? There's a chance that they know exactly what happened to Nancy and she is in Mexico. So imagine what happens now when everything comes out, an arrest is made, it's a huge deal, and we find out that from such and such a date, they knew they were in Mexico, yet they have the Cajun Navy searching, Madres Buscadoras, and EcuSearch spending weeks there when they knew that she wasn't there. So I said, let's just give them the benefit of the doubt with this decision making. But now there's just so much. It just seems like he wants to be the hero, even though he was at a basketball game, literally right before and after, I believe it might be right after or before those, that initial statements were made by the family. Like they're getting ready to go on and bare their souls. And he's at a hoops game.
Yeah. His optics are horrendous. And I'm with you, Jen. You know, when I researched the stats on him as the department, and then I looked at other people in positions like his with big cases, and when you look at the numbers, he's average. You know, his department is really good for clearance rates, which says, hey, we got good investigators, but that's, again, not because of him, maybe in spite of him. But all these other things are just, he wore himself down. He wore his own credibility down. No one else did it for him. Like you said, I'm curious, what do you think the impact on the investigation, on the investigators themselves is because of those actions?
That is such a great question. And this is where I look at it right now. For instance, there's a guy that was his supervisor. Some of you, he's been interviewing all over God's green earth, but he, which is great because he's trying, obviously he cannot stand Nanos. He was his supervisor. He is, I believe, the most experienced in terms of years of a sergeant they have in their department. And they have the guy answering phones about, you know, missing cats and, you know, whatever. And you look at that and you just ask yourself, to me, you look at it and you say, whoa, wait a minute. Why, if these are these little vendettas that he has, and I think that's the biggest part of this no confidence vote, is that you, if he doesn't like you, he gets rid of you. He deep sixes you. He makes it so you're not working. And what if that guy is the guy that had the thought process that could have led or saw the clue that meant this could have been solved? I'm just saying, the more brains with the most experience, that's who you want out there in this. You 100%. Don't want to find a telephone. So I think it has a lot of impact, not just morale, but much more significant than just morale.
Yeah, because in as telling Tony the other day, you know, inside organizations with people like this, been there, done that, you typically find a way to work around people like that, you know, because you know, hey, they're just looking up out for their promotion. They're just taking care of themselves. Hey, no big deal. I'm not going to hold it against you. That's your thing. But I'm going to do the righteous work here. And I know how to work you so I can work my cases. That happens all the time in organizations. But like you said, in this case, he's derailing the investigation potentially because he's taking those righteous workers that are there for the mission and removing them from the mission. And they have years and generations of reps that they're bringing to the fight. And so, as I said the other day, he might not be derailing it, but he's slowing it down. But if you are actually removing these successful people, in other words, he has these high clearance rates, like 90% for the last 5 years or above, and 100% in 2024. But if you're removing the guys from those positions that got you that, that is really a problem.
Is his goal to be the superhero here at the end of the day? Is it to be the one who I don't know that you walk back from any of this or fix your image at this point when everybody has no confidence in you? Unless, you know, he, you know, delivers Nancy Guthrie alive on a platter tomorrow. In lieu of that, I don't see anything that's going to save his image. But does he care? Does he even care what people think of him? I'm going to go with no. I don't think it even you know, bothers him in the least of any sort of negative opinions that people have about him, because it seems it's kind of been his track record. It's just white noise at this point, it seems.
Well, you know, Robin and I think we'll agree on this point, that past behavior is a predictor of future behavior, and past things that happen in the past predict what will happen in the future. And when you look at the Idaho 4 case, which there's only really about a handful of cases that were ever this big, right? JonBenet Ramsey, Gabby Petito, the Idaho 4, off the top of my head, Lacey Peterson, that just blew up and exploded like this for an extended period of time. And when you look at the Idaho 4 case and Chief Fry, which, by the way, I actually really liked Chief Fry. I felt terrible for him because the fact of his messaging was such a train wreck, like saying that nobody out there is dangerous. And what happened to him? He retired after that case, and then he tried to be a sheriff there in his own Latah County and lost by a huge margin. And so my point here is, I don't think there's any way that Sheriff Nanos will ever survive this. But look, I loved Chief Fry generally. I mean, I think he good-hearted, hardworking guy that just was over his head, so to speak. But when I say over his head, I mean, just having a case that would be all over almost anybody's head.
Yeah, absolutely.
But when you look at this guy, oh my gosh, he has such a different way of coming off that is so unlikable and arrogant and all the words you know, and I think he's a fighter. I think he'll throw out anything, any sort of mud against the fence. I think he goes after people who disagree with him and tries mm-hmm. to them. And I don't think he's going to go away. They're going to have to drag him kicking and screaming to get him off the sheriff's stage.
Which does that mean he just has to run out his term? I mean, I know they're trying to do the recall election, which, I mean, that's a feat unto itself to try right. and accomplish that. I mean, could it be done? Sure. But, you know, again, my microwave could take me to the moon, too. I don't know that it will. But, you know, it's like, yeah, the technology is better, but it's not going to do it. So, like, what do you think there's any lever that's going to be pulled that's going to get him out of here? Him resigning? Or is it just going to be, he's got what, a couple years left, and then as he doesn't get reelected?
I think that's the future.
Yeah.
I doubt this recall election will work unless they have tens of thousands of people collecting votes, because they've got to get 10,000 votes a day. They've got only 120 days to get, it's actually over 120,000 votes that they need because right. it's a percentage. It's so rare. I mean, I looked up all these cases and they haven't been able to do it in the past. I don't think it's possible because of, not that people don't want to sign it, but just also think how many people have no idea who Sheriff Nanos is.
Yeah.
Right. And to also your point, you know, we agree on a lot, Jen. and especially when it comes to Chief Fry, I love judging an individual also by how the people around them view them. And his department was really good. I like their handling of a lot of things. You could see how they interact with the community, because how they interact with the community is how they're interacting internally. And again, when you see healthy communication, healthy behavior, that comes from the top. And so he might, like I'm with you, not experienced. That went from 0 to 100 in his span there. I think, what was it? I think it was only 14 years ago prior to that murder of Koberger is when they actually had their last murder. I mean, there's no reps there. And so, but again, good, healthier community, good, healthier culture where people liked him. Nanos, mm-hmm. completely different. Everyone, I mean, who came out and said they liked him? Who's defending him?
No one.
No one person.
I actually, early on, I mean, it was funny because I'm not saying trying to make excuses, but I would at least say, hey, listen, this is a tough job. He's got a lot going on.
Yep.
These are his statements, which I don't think he would do if the Bureau wasn't behind them. I don't know. I try to give some leniency toward these guys, but he's a hard one. I guarantee you Chief Fry does not have a souped up vet he's squirreling around in the middle of this case.
And herein lies, then it goes to that question too. Should these people in these positions be elected or appointed? Because Chief Fry, he wasn't elected. I mean, he rose to the ranks, and this is a position he got because he had experience. He's, you know, you're groomed into it, you're trained into it, and as opposed to elected into it, because that adds a whole nother dimension to this. You know, we were talking about this the other day too, is, you know, this guy's elected like our politicians are elected, who can't lead themselves out of a paper bag 90% of the time, you know. So why should that be the same process for someone who actually, like this, is going to be literally responsible and leading hundreds of lives and then responsible for hundreds of thousands of lives in the territory that they're covering? That's a different kind of thing. You need to have different levers you can pull to remove morons from bad positions.
Yeah, I would agree. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in there. We'll continue the conversation right there.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Savannah Guthrie sat across from Hoda Kotb weeks into the worst experience of her life and said something that stopped me cold. She said she believes two of the ransom notes her family received about her mother are real. Not all of them. She was clear about that. Most of them, in her understanding, are fake. She didn't even see those. But the two her family responded to, the two that sent her and her siblings to Instagram recording videos begging a stranger to prove their mother was still breathing, those, she said, she tends to believe are real. I want you to sit with that word for a second. Tens. That's not certainly that certainty. That's not an investigative conclusion backed by forensic analysis. That is a daughter reaching for something to hold on to and a nightmare that has offered her almost nothing to grip. And I don't fault her. Not for one second. But we owe it to Savannah, we owe it to the Guthrie family, and we owe it to Nancy to look at what that belief is actually built on. Because when a family this visible tells the world they believe a ransom note is real, it shapes how millions of people understand this case. And the evidence behind that belief deserves the same scrutiny we would give anything else. I invite your opinions and your thoughts, there's no right or wrong, in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Links are in the description. So let's look at what these notes actually contain, what they didn't contain, and what history tells us about ransom communications in cases exactly like this one. Within days of Nancy Guthrie's disappearance, ransom communications started flooding in. They were sent to KOLD, the CBS affiliate in Tucson. They went to TMZ. They went to KGON, another television station there in Tucson. They went directly to the Guthrie family. The FBI confirmed that the notes sent to media outlets were identical. The same document distributed to multiple newsrooms. They demanded millions in Bitcoin. They set two deadlines, Friday, or rather February 5th at 5 p.m., and then February 9th. They referenced Nancy's Apple Watch and a damaged floodlight at her home. And they opened stating that Nancy was okay, but scared. Harvey Levin, the founder of TMZ, called the notes carefully crafted and layered. He said the grammar was perfect, the structure deliberate. He pointed specifically to a detail about the placement of Nancy's Apple Watch, where it was found inside the home, as something that hadn't been publicly reported. He told News Nation that the insider details were the kind only someone present at the scene would know. KOLD anchor Mary Coleman echoed that assessment. She said when her station received the note, it was clear within a couple of sentences that it might not be a hoax because it contained very sensitive information. Anonymous law enforcement sources told the Los Angeles Times that the notes included at least two details about the home that hadn't been made public. That sounds compelling. And if the story ended there, you might lean towards believing the notes carry weight. But it doesn't end there. At the February 5th press conference, the same week those notes arrived, FBI special agent in charge, Heath Janke, addressed the content directly. He confirmed the notes referenced an Apple Watch and a floodlight. And then he said something that cuts directly against the narrative that these details prove insider knowledge. He said the information was publicly available. That's the FBI's lead agent on the case, standing at the podium, telling reporters that the details journalists found so convincing were accessible to anyone paying attention. And he wasn't alone in that assessment. Retired ATF agent Jim Cavanaugh pointed out that if you Google Nancy Guthrie photos from the Today Show set that come up, where she's wearing an Apple Watch, clearly visible on her wrist, anybody sitting anywhere could hit Google and see those pictures and demand Bitcoin, he said. So now we have two compelling conclusions drawn from the same set of details. The journalists who received the notes believe the information could only come from someone who was there. The FBI's own lead agent says the information was publicly available. That contradiction has never been resolved publicly, and it sits at the foundation of everything Savannah believes about the two notes. I want to say this. Opinions of journalists, YouTubers, myself, whoever, they are exactly that, opinions. They are not conclusions. They are not definitive conclusions. Now, I can come to a conclusion in my mind, but it's still my opinion of what I've concluded. It is not a fact. So because a reporter at a television station in Tucson, and whoever else says it couldn't have come from anywhere else. Well, what are you basing that on? Because it kind of looks like that, because you go, there's no way, no one. Yeah, I mean, it does look specific. And if somebody is out there trying to make you think they have inside knowledge, all you had to do was look at the Today Show archive and you could find a handful of Nancy Guthrie videos, even videos of her in her own bedroom. And I'm not faulting Savannah for doing bits with her mom and pieces with her mom and showing her mom in her house. That is normal stuff. People have done it for decades and nobody's dead. And I honestly don't think those bits had anything to do with her disappearance. I think they may have everything to do with fake ransom notes, trying to make you think somebody has her. But I don't think they actually have anything to do with the planning or taking of Nancy Guthrie. Again, my opinion, not fact. That's how quickly this stuff moves. On this show, me and Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. He's got a track record, got an opinion that people listen to. But everything he says, too, opinion. I've seen stories that literally just take our show and then suddenly publish it as a news story. I've seen The Sun do it. I've seen many publications do it. I've seen it all over the internet. I've seen it, you know, you name it. Someone has done a story on a story we've started here. And what we're doing here is not a story. What we're doing here is opinion journalism. We're discussing a case. Me saying something out loud doesn't make it fact. One of my guests saying something out loud doesn't make it fact. You can put a bunch of these people together in a piece and go, see, all these people say this, but the FBI says something different. I'm going to go to the FBI because they're the ones that are actually doing the investigating. What I'm doing is sitting here expressing the opinions of the dots I'm connecting in my head and on my notepad as I sit here and absorb the information. One's boots on the ground. One is sitting in a studio in Arkansas, regurgitating news and giving opinions. Big difference. So I think that's important to understand as we run all of this information through our news cycle brains and land on what is fact versus fiction versus opinion. Now, could this be right? Could there be somebody that maybe, and we haven't seen the damn notes. We've heard what the notes contain, or at least somewhat of what they contain. But yes, really, truly, the information in those notes could have been gleaned from those other videos. And it sounds amazing, and it sounds convincing, and it looks convincing. Robin Drake did an experiment about it with his own family. He had AI write a fake ransom note based on information online that exists about things around him. And damn, did it come up with a convincing note from not a human that has never been to his home. It's easy to believe things when you want to believe them. Not that anybody wants to believe that this could even happen to begin with. But when you're searching for answers and you're searching for a sign of life, and someone mentions something that seems like only they might know, but where a watch is placed on a nightstand where you could actually see it in a video, the mind is quick to discount little things like that. Well, could it be seen in the... Yeah, it could be, but who's going to do that? Well, it turns out a lot of people who want to make a lot of money are the people who would do that. but we are good as human beings of discounting those things and applying what we want to apply to a specific situation to make it make sense to us, because we're constantly in the back of our mind, in our subconscious, trying to make sense of everything that's going on. And if it doesn't make sense, we fill in the blanks. It's what we do as humans. It's not a fault. It's just what we do. And I don't blame Savannah for putting those dots together and coming to that conclusion. And look, she may be completely right. What I'm expressing to you is my opinion. And it's just that, an opinion. But it's worth looking at everything. We don't have Nancy. So to say the notes are bunk, that's an opinion. To say the notes have validity, that's an opinion too. Both should have the same weight. Everyone is entitled to their own, and I'm curious to see yours as we continue to work through this in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. But even if we set that dispute aside, even if we give the notes the benefit of the doubt on the Apple Watch and the floodlight, the way these communications behaved tells a story that doesn't align with how real kidnapping for ransom operations work. And I need to walk through this because it matters. The notes demanded millions in Bitcoin. They provided a wallet address, but they provided no way for the family to contact the sender. No phone number, no email address, no dead drop location, no encrypted channel, nothing. I mean, think about that. If you have abducted someone and you want money for their return, the single most important thing you need is a line of communication with the people who have the money. You need to negotiate. You need to coordinate a handoff. You need to prove you have what they want so they'll give you what you want. These notes did none of that. They made a demand into the void and then went silent. The family begged for proof of life. Savannah recorded videos. Cameron recorded a video. They posted them publicly on Instagram. They said explicitly on camera that they needed to know their mother was alive. They said they were ready to talk. They said they would pay. They responded. The response they got? Silence. No photo of Nancy holding a newspaper, no recording of her voice, no detail about her condition that couldn't be pulled from existing coverage. Nothing. Both deadlines came and went. February 5th, 5 p.m., the note warned the demand would change. February 9th, the note warned of far more consequential outcomes. The Bitcoin wallet was monitored in real time by TMZ, by law enforcement, by anyone who knew the address. Zero transactions in, zero out. The deadlines passed and nothing happened. No consequences materialized, no follow-up demands, no escalation, just silence. And then there's this. The first note cited explicitly that there would be no further communication. This was it. Take it or leave it. Then a second message derived to KOLD from a different IP address using similar cloaking software, but different in almost every way from the first. According to the station's news director, Jessica Bulba, it made no new demands. It provided no proof of life. If this is the same person, they're contradicting their own stated terms. If it's a different person, we're looking at copycats stacking on top of each other, which is exactly what the historical pattern predicts. Every single hallmark of a legitimate ransom negotiation, communication channels, proof of life, escalating demands, and actual exchange is absent. What's left in a well-written is a well-written document that references details the FBI's lead agent called publicly available. Information demands untraceable cryptocurrency and then vanishes into silence when the family asks for the one thing that would prove it is real. So why does Savannah believe? And this is a part you have to take with compassion, because it's not about being right or wrong. It's about what grief does to a human being. Savannah Guthrie broke down during that interview through tears. She said something that reveals the emotional architecture underneath her belief about those notes. She said she's terrified that her fame, her success, her wealth, that being Savannah Guthrie is what brought this to her mother's door. Quote, to think that I brought this to her bedside that it's because of me. I'm so sorry, Mommy. I'm so sorry. If you carry that guilt, if you believe in your bones that your career painted a target on your 84-year-old mother's back, then a ransom note is not just a piece of paper. It's a framework that makes the horror make sense. Someone took her for money, which means someone has her, which means she might still be alive somewhere, which means there's still a transaction that can bring her home. There's still something you can do. There's still a door. That's what you're feeling. That's what Savannah's feeling. At least that's, again, my opinion, my interpretation. I can't tell you what she's feeling. That's how I'd be feeling. The alternative, this was a burglary gone wrong, that someone improvised something horrible. And when they realized a camera was watching, that the notes are opportunistic noise from strangers who saw a famous family in agony and decided, hey, it's payday. That alternative offers nothing. No negotiation, no channel, no path back to Nancy. Just a void where your mother used to be and no one on the other end of the line. That's not stupidity. That's not naivete. That is what extreme grief and guilt do to the human brain's desperate need for a narrative that contains hope. Savannah is not wrong to feel what she feels, but feeling and evidence operate on different frequencies. And in a case where an 84-year-old woman's life may hang in the balance, the distinction between the two matters more than it's comfortable to say out loud. And here's the thing about ransom fraud and high-profile cases. It's not a new phenomenon. It's not unusual. It's not a fringe occurrence. It's one of the most documented predictable patterns in the history of American crime. In 1932, when the Lindbergh baby was kidnapped, a real abductor did send ransom notes. So did dozens of strangers. Fake communications flooded in from opportunists trying to insert themselves into the investigation or extract money from the family. The real notes were eventually identified through forensic handwriting analysis, but the noise nearly buried the signal, and the child was found dead regardless. In 1973, when John Paul Getty III was kidnapped in Rome, his own grandfather initially refused to pay because he suspected the whole thing was a hoax. And he wasn't entirely irrational for thinking so. Opportunists were already sending fake notes and calling the family claiming to know the kidnappers. It took the actual abductors mailing the boy's severed ear to an Italian newspaper before the family was convinced the demand was real. The proof of life, as horrific as it was, is what separated the legitimate communication from the fraud. Without it, the family couldn't tell the difference. In 2002, while Elizabeth Smart was still missing from her Salt Lake City bedroom, police received fake ransom emails demanding millions and threatening to harm her. The man behind them had absolutely no connection to the abduction. He pled guilty to federal charges. Smart was eventually found alive 9 months later, rescued by alert citizens, not ransomed. And in this very case, we already have a confirmed example. Derek Kalala, a 42-year-old from Hawthorne, California, with a prior fraud charge, admitted to the FBI that he sent fake Bitcoin demands to Annie Guthrie and her husband, Tommaso Cioni. Told agents he'd been watching TV coverage and was trying to see if the family would respond. He used a VOIP app to disguise his number. He registered it to his personal Gmail address. He was arrested by an FBI SWAT team, charged federally, and his communications were confirmed to have no connection whatsoever to whoever took Nancy. The pattern is consistent across nearly a century. High-profile abduction plus media saturation equals ransom fraud. The vultures always show up. The question is never whether fake notes will arrive. They always do. The question is whether any of them are real. And across all of those cases, the only reliable way to separate real from fake has been the same. Proof of life, direct communication, and demands that evolved through actual negotiation, none of which have materialized in the Guthrie case. Now, the forensic linguistics angle remains an open question. The notes were described as grammatically polished, well-structured, and written with what multiple people interpreted as familiarity with the Tucson area. It's worth noting, but it's also not hard to fake. We live in 2026. AI-assisted writing can produce grammatically flawless, locally specific content in seconds. Grammatical polish is no longer the differentiator it once was. And local familiarity with the Catalina foothills, the neighborhood, the terrain, the way people talk about it can be absorbed from a few minutes of cable news coverage. None of this provides or proves the notes are fake. I want to be clear about that. The FBI has not publicly confirmed or denied the authenticity of the primary ransom communications. That determination, if it's been made, hasn't been shared with the public. What I can say is that every piece of publicly available evidence, the absent proof of life, the empty Bitcoin wallet, the blown deadlines, the silence after the family's pleas, the contradictory second message, the FBI's own characterization of the key details is publicly available, and the confirmed arrest of at least one opportunist points in one direction, and it's not the direction Savannah is hoping for. Savannah said something during that interview that has nothing to do with evidence and everything to do with the human cost of this case. Speaking about the people who sent fake ransom notes to her family, people who looked at a mother's disappearance and saw an opportunity, she said, a person that would send a fake ransom note really has to look deeply at themselves. To a family in pain. She's right about that. Whatever else remains unsolved in this investigation, she's absolutely right about that. The Guthrie family asked for proof of life and got grifters. They posted videos begging for contact and got silence. They said they would pay, said it publicly on camera with tears running down their faces, and the wallet sat at zero while strangers in California type Bitcoin demands from their couches. That's not a kidnapping negotiation. That's a family being circled by people who saw suffering and smelled money. And every historical case in the book confirms it. When a famous family loses someone, the fraudsters arrive before the investigators finish processing the scene. The notes may still hold forensic value. The FBI may have information. The public doesn't. I'm not closing any doors, but what I'm saying with full respect for what Savannah Guthrie and her family are enduring is that a daughter's belief, no matter how deeply felt, is not the same as evidence. And right now, the evidence and the belief are pointed in very different directions. Both of those things can be true at the same time. The notes can be exploitative, fraud, and Savannah's pain can be completely, devastatingly real. One does not cancel the other. And Nancy Guthrie, whether she deserves an investigation guided by evidence, not by the hope that any of these notes will lead someone back to her. That's what she deserves. Because hope is not a strategy. And Nancy is still missing. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Are they real? Why do you think so? And I'm going to say this. If you think they're real, I don't think you fully grasp just how well AI works. Because if you gave me your address, your name, I could probably come up with a pretty convincing ransom note that would make people think I know you well. It's amazing what can be done today with the smallest amount of effort and a keyboard. It's scary. And if I know how to do it, as a reporter here talking about this case, trust me, the people who are using this stuff nefariously, they know how to do it 10 times better than I do. But again, it's an opinion. And I too hold on to hope for Nancy. But I also am grounded in the reality of where we're at. and to get to the reality of where we're at for a family in grief, that's up to them. When and how, that's their terms. It's not for me to say, that's not for you to say, it's not for anybody to say. That's a process only those individuals can go through at their own pace. Unfortunately, they have cameras on them, watching their every move and every statement and breaking down everything they say. But as observers out here, that's my point. Understand opinion versus fact versus fiction. There are three different lanes. We'll continue our conversation in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. The links are in the description. Join us over on Substack right now, please. It's absolutely free. There's no paywall. And you'll be part of our exclusive community. You also get our videos and our reporting a day before they go out everywhere else. So do check that out. All right. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.